Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
Coming up on the show, we're going to be speaking to political commentator and writer Stella Tan-Ikidu on the question, did Labour let down abused women?
Later on in the programme, we'll be doing the Week Unwrapped. That's right, a format change, because joining us in the studio now is Zoe Crowther, a political reporter for Politics Home, who is here to break down the AI divide among MPs. Zoe, thank you so much for being here with us today.
So, Zoe, you wrote this great piece this week in Politics Home entitled MPs are divided over whether they should use AI to do their jobs. I think much like most of us. Let's talk a bit about how this is playing out amongst MPs. Can you just begin by breaking down what exactly the divide is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's no secret to anyone in Parliament and generally the world of work that AI has taken the world a little bit by storm in the last few years. I started reporting on the use of AI by MPs back in 2022, 2023. So this isn't necessarily new, but I think what's new is MPs being much more open about it and really starting to experiment with how they use AI in their jobs. So a month ago, we saw Mark Sewards, the Labour MP, launch an AI version of himself, which is to kind of answer questions from constituents. I tested it out. Got him to say some pretty wacky things. And then very shortly after, he sent me a somewhat panicked text saying that they'd had to further restrict the model based on my testing of it. So that's one example. And then more recently, we've had Labour MP Mike Reader spotted on the train using ChatGPT to essentially draft correspondence with constituents. That maybe went down well in some circles, not so well in others. But it basically prompted him to then write for us that he kind of strongly believes that you should be using ChatGPT and other forms of AI. So that's the kind of pro AI MPs, and there's a whole camp of them. But then a lot of other MPs feel like it's maybe a risk to constituent data. If you're not careful about how you're handling that, it could undermine public trust in MPs, which is obviously already so low. And as one MP put it to me, people already feel like there's a divide between the general public and politicians. So is almost, in their words, kind of hiding behind a machine going to help that? Maybe not. So there are all kinds of debates going on. And the piece that I wrote this week essentially just kind of spoke to different MPs across that divide, what they were thinking about it, and also had various MPs express their cynicism, I suppose, about some of their colleagues' uses of it and whether actually it's helpful at all and whether it can actually end up taking up more time, not less.
Do you think there's an age divide between who's using it? Is it the case where younger MPs are a little bit more open and liberal to the idea of using new technology, whereas older MPs, and let's be honest, the majority of them are like 132 years old, are they less likely to use it?
Definitely. I think there's it's a bit inevitable that younger and newer MPs who are new into Parliament and keen to kind of communicate fresh ideas and show that they're trying to do politics and media a little bit differently. I think that's true. And I've also heard that there are MPs still who only prefer to communicate with constituents in written letter form rather than over email. And emails have been around for quite some time. So that gives you a little bit of an indication about of how some members of Parliament will take quite some time to catch up.
There are still some MPs, or there were when I was a select committee clerk, who insisted on having their briefings printed out and handed to them, sometimes run over from the building where the clerks live, rather than just going on their iPads that are given to them so they don't have to do that. So yes, I can totally see that. Can you tell us a bit about this conversation with Mark Sewards, please? I really want to know what happened.
So it was really interesting because I went into it knowing basically for certain that I was going to find some kind of loophole or some answer that it would give to me that wouldn't be quite what he wanted it to.
Can I ask quickly? I don't know anything. I just admitted to Zoe earlier that I've only used ChatGPT like once or twice. What did he, so he created like a model of himself?
Yeah, so it's basically like an AI avatar. So he's got an avatar of his face. You click onto this website, and then you have to speak into the tool. So you can't type it out like on ChatGPT.
Right.
You have to speak into it yourself. And then his AI version of himself basically then speaks back to you. So say I was a constituent. I go onto this website. I say, I'm a constituent in your area, I'm struggling with my housing situation, please can you help me? And then it will give you a response. Or you can ask him about his policy position.
And the response, presumably, is the AI will predict what he would have said if he'd been in there. Okay.
And so what
could go wrong?
Oh,
yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, nothing at all. And basically what he had clearly done was that he'd carried out interviews with staff. So it had picked up his voice. Mm. So it answers very realistically in his voice with a Leeds accent. And he'd fed certain policies into it as well. So it was based on contributions that he'd made in Parliament, but also specific things that maybe he hadn't said in Parliament, but he'd fed into the model.
I honestly, half the time I don't trust myself when I'm doing media, let alone having a... so what you were halfway through the story when I interrupted you. What sort of stuff did you find when you...
Basically, it was very, very safe on policy, generally. So everything I asked it... I asked it about winter fuel allowance. I tried to ask it about things that might throw up some controversy or some kind of dividing line with the Labour government. Did none of that. Stayed very safe, very on message. The only kind of political things that I could get it to go slightly off piste was that it was very critical of New Labour, Tony Blair's record in Iraq, which I did research afterwards. Mark Sowards had never said anything about Iraq publicly. And he confirmed to me that he'd actually fed that opinion into the model, even though he hadn't previously publicly spoke on it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The only bits where I could get it to say things that he wasn't happy about was where you went a little bit more personal. I got him to write a Tinder bio for Mark Sowards. He did it.
Was it a good bio?
I wouldn't say so. No. I mean, it was very like... politically dry. Like, love to chat politics over a cup of tea. Like, it was just very, very bland. Very bland. But still, wasn't something that he wanted the model to be putting out there necessarily. He is married with children, by the way. And then I got him to say which of his Labour colleagues he would like to see on I'm a Celeb. He said Rachel Reeves. How would Rachel Reeves do on I'm a Celeb? Apparently, she'd excel at some of the more kind of being determined and really pushing through some of the tasks, but would maybe struggle with more of the physical elements of the trials. So there were just various things like that that I got him to say that afterwards he clearly wasn't too happy about, but essentially put his hands up and said, look, this is a work in progress. We're now amending the model to make sure that it doesn't spout any of those answers. But I think the real crux of the issue here is that... it's something that is meant to kind of help constituents. But if you're a constituent and you're asking it pretty much most questions that are quite niche usually and quite detailed and personal and vulnerable, the set of answers, because he's done it in such a safe way, is really, really limited. So most of the time, it only has the scope to essentially just come back and say, I can't answer this question right now, but if you want to send us an email or if you want to look elsewhere. So it ended up being a little bit... as one MP, other MP put it to me, maybe a little bit more of a branding exercise than an actual helpful tool for constituents.
I think it's really fascinating though, because we're in a really interesting place of like, we're in between probably a technological revolution with AI, and we're at that beginning stage. And we've spoken so much about the impacts that's going to have on our economy and the impacts that's going to have on technology and other things, but we haven't really spoken about the impact that's going to have on our actual political leaders and politicians. I have a question on the security of it all. There are different versions of AI, as I've learned, some of which are state-owned by countries like China. Has there been any concern raised to you about restricting... for example, we restricted the use of TikTok on the parliamentary estate. Has there been any concerns around security of which AI platform is used and who it's owned by?
Yeah, I think there are different sliding scales of which AI programs... people in politics are kind of accepted to use. So at the moment, Microsoft Copilot, for example, is used across government and the civil service. And Parliament is also kind of doing a Copilot trial scheme of it among some MPs. However, with Copilot, it's much more limited. It doesn't necessarily link to the wider internet. It's just kind of you feed in what you want to, and then it can give you a synopsis or a summary of a briefing or something like that. So it's a bit more limited. I think where the concerns are around things like ChatGPT, which is obviously owned by OpenAI, And to be honest, a lot of smaller third-party companies that we really don't know that much about. And it's not just the AI tools themselves that MPs and public figures are going to use. It's which companies are they going to get the AI training from for their staff and for themselves. That it's not just the tools, it's all of the other third-party companies that are going to move in to fill this space, when at the moment in the public sector, that's really a space that's like not being filled, if you see what I mean. And it's something that's come through in a few conversations with MPs over the last few days, that the data question and just exactly what are MPs feeding into these pieces of software, how is that information then going to be used? And obviously constituents would like to feel that their data is secure when they're sharing really vulnerable, important parts of their lives with their elected politicians.
It feels to me like this Labour government is betting a lot, actually, on artificial intelligence to improve public services, to pick the UK economy out of its black hole. We've heard a lot about embracing this AI revolution. And in fact, it was recently reported that the Secretary of State for Science and Technology, Peter Kyle, may have had a meeting with Sam Altman, who was obviously the CEO of ChatGPT, discussing a £2 billion deal to give ChatGPT Plus to all UK residents. I mean, and then on the other hand, you know, you're talking about MPs, including Labour MPs, who seem quite sceptical of the use of AI and worried about it. Is there, are you getting that there is a bit of a discrepancy between the government's position and actually its own MPs, including Labour MPs, on how to use AI and how, you know, employers should use AI?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think realistically, most MPs and probably most people in government, if they were being realistic about it, know that AI in general cannot be a silver bullet for all of the many problems that this country is facing. You know, best case, it's a very handy productivity tool, just in the same way that the internet, emails, I mean, all of those things did fundamentally change the way we work and the way we communicate. But ultimately, the most important thing at the heart of that will be what politicians are setting out to be the vision for the country and how they deliver that vision and how that actually makes an impact on people's lives. And I think at least in the near future, things like ChatGPT aren't going to fundamentally change that. And it's certainly something that comes through when you're talking to MPs about how they use it. At the moment, it is still limited. And if they do use it to kind of help draft correspondence or help draft their speeches or things like that, they all insist that they're still having those human checks done, that, you know, they still take as much time to do all of the due diligence. So if anything, it actually almost ends up taking up more time at the moment. And only as the tools improve will the regulation then try to catch up with that. But I think what the government is trying to do is trying to show that it can be a little bit ahead of the curve on it compared to, for example, with social media, where it did feel like social media kind of took the world by storm and government took, if not years, maybe even decades to actually catch up. I mean, the Online Safety Act has only just come into legislation.
But it is interesting as well. I mean, it occurs to me that one of the things that I think people feel about using ChatGPT in work is it's almost like a shortcut. It can be lazy. And I think some of the concerns, particularly about, the MP Mike Reader using ChatGPT, or some of the criticisms was that it's, as you say, people already think that their MPs don't really care about them. If you're just shoving caseworker or constituent emails into ChatGPT and getting responses, it feels like almost lazy. But as you say, you know, it is a productivity tool. You know, and MPs are always complaining about being overloaded with casework. I mean, how much of this is just, do you think, is just a cultural issue that needs to be overcome? The idea that MPs should be working all hours as hard as they can, otherwise they're not really putting in enough effort.
I think it's something to pay really close attention to make sure that these tools aren't being used in the wrong way. But I think fundamentally the problem isn't necessarily with the tool itself. It's how people use it, right? It's how people might use shortcuts where they shouldn't, or how people might, or how regulation doesn't kind of catch up with technology at the pace that it should. And I think a lot of the conversations that I have with MPs about AI, but generally technology, actually the issue ends up not being about the technology itself, but about the fact that MPs feel like they don't have enough resources to do their job, or that the nature of their job has changed so much over the last few decades, and they've got more casework to deal with than ever before. That was something that really came through, and so many MPs were saying, look, I get this is about AI, this is a story about AI, but can you just make the point of we need double the staff budget, or we need the, you know, and a lot of them felt like some of their colleagues were almost being backed into a corner of having to use AI because those resources aren't there for them.
Do you think right now there's no limitations, no regulation about what you what MPs can and cannot use as it relates to AI, right?
No.
So if an MP wanted to stick a constituent's information into the AI system owned by the Chinese state, they could do that. There's no regulation in Parliament against it.
I don't actually know specifically as to the regulation around constituent data. I can't give you an answer to that right now.
Let's forget the GDPR. Even if they wanted to do their parliamentary speeches or if they wanted to create a model of themselves.
Fine. Yeah. So using an MP gave a speech that was AI generated in Parliament in 2022, Luke Evans. He did it as a point and he did it openly.
Right.
But yeah, there's absolutely nothing to stop the material being produced by an MP being AI generated, whether that's a speech, whether that's
because the thing that concerns me is there was a major controversy, I don't know if either of you guys saw it, around WeTransfer, and WeTransfer changed their terms and conditions to say anything that you upload moving forward, they have either an intellectual or copyright to and own it. I can imagine, I don't know about ChatGPT, but AI softwares elsewhere taking that information and using it either for nefarious reasons or just commercial reasons, right? Doing being able to monitor, for example, I can imagine a commercial market in being able to mass data serve what the views and opinions of politicians is, what kind of speeches they're given, how often they're logging on, that kind of stuff. No regulation for that whatsoever. And if so, surely we're going to need to move on it. The question is, are we going to move as slowly we did with social media and take 10 years to do it? Or
it really remains to be seen. The artificial intelligence bill was something that had been much touted by Labour figures, including the Secretary of State, Peter Carl, himself. We now don't really know when the AI bill is going to actually come down the track. We know that originally it was going to be quite limited in scope anyway. Will that scope be widened? Will it be lessened even further? That is all still up in the air. And there's a lot of kind of safety campaigners who are concerned.
I have
about
one last
that.
Question, though, if that's all right. You guys are both journalists. How often do you guys use it, or your colleagues? Maybe you don't want to talk about yourselves, but your colleagues. Is it widely being used?
I fully admit that I use it a lot. And I think that's actually really important for me, too, because it's an area that I've been reporting on a fair amount. And I think the only way that you can understand these issues fully is by playing with it yourself, just like when I was testing Mark Seward's kind of AI version. Yeah. So I mostly use it to, if say there's a long report that I want to read,
summarize
or
it.
A big story that I don't have time to fully read all the way through, I'll put that in. Sometimes I get it to kind of prompt ideas for social media posts, for example, from stories that I've written. Sometimes I might ask it for suggestions about how to structure something. Sometimes its suggestions will be really bad. And my personal concern is that I'm obviously a journalist who's been doing this for a few years. I'm fully trained as a journalist. So I like to think that I've got quite a good eye for when ChatGPT is giving me not so great suggestions. My concern would be for maybe early career journalists or student journalists who are just getting started, just blindly taking what ChatGPT gives them.
I think I'd pretty much agree with that. And I'd just add that you definitely have to check everything ChatGPT generates, because it's not always correct. It does hallucinate. And do try and always write originally, because it can also, if you rely on it too much, you you forget to put a sentence together.
I can't wait for the time that an MP has the whip withdrawn, not for something they said, but for something their AI model said. Zoe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have, but we would really love to have you back on, because this is obviously going to grow and be a bigger story as we move forward. You can follow Zoe on her social media, on Instagram at Zoe Crowther, Zoe.Crowther, and you can follow her articles at Politics Home website. Coming up after the break, we'll be speaking to Tan Ekidu about Labour's policies on domestic violence risk assessment.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
I'm enjoying doing the intros this week. I feel very powerful. But we are going to be talking to the brilliant Stella Tanikidou about whether Labour has let down abused women. She's asked this question in the New Statesman this week and written a brilliant piece about it. Stella, thank you so much for speaking to us today. How are you?
Hello. Thank you for having me, guys. I'm very well.
Excellent.
I'm in Greece, actually, but very excited.
Oh, you're so much better than us, then.
I'm quite angry.
Well, thank you for joining us anyway from Greece. I'm very, very jealous. Let's talk about your piece, Stella. You write that the government have tasked the domestic violence charity Safe Lives to lead a review process into the risk assessment tool that they themselves have created. And you've pointed out all the kind of hypocrisies and the problems around this. Can you just take us through the thrust of your article?
So the first thing I should say that the Home Office at the moment is denying that the review is specifically about the tool. And the review, indeed, it wasn't specifically about the tool. And that's not what I'm trying to suggest in the article. It was a general risk assessment. It was a general review into risk assessment. And how does the UK domestic violence sector, the police and frontline services do risk assessment for domestic violence services? Well, the majority of our staff, the majority of our frontline staff, and the majority of police forces, especially until recently, have been using DAS, the DAS questionnaire. DAS stands for Domestic Abuse, Stalking, and Honor-Based Violence. And it is a questionnaire that was created in 2009 by a charity called Safe Lives, which is a massive charity. It's very well respected in the domestic violence sector. It has done a lot of great works, a lot of great work. And one of the amazing things that they did when they first started with us is they said, we're going to create a system where organizations can speak to each other so that they can alert each other, so that you can alert the police of the seriousness of a specific case and to give something for caseworkers to work through. However, DAS is not validated as a risk assessment tool. And that is why wherever you go online, on Safe Lives website, you will see it being referred to as a questionnaire. But everybody in the sector where I used to work for a big criminal justice organization, one of the biggest government service providers in the country. I was head of policy, and everybody would refer to DAS as a risk assessment tool. Now, what happens is that DAS works as a sorting hat to identify the women who are at most risk. So depending on the score that you get on this questionnaire, a woman is going to be given more help and resources, for example, being given a spot at a domestic abuse shelter, or they will be told, it's okay, we will check in with you again, but you are free to go home, you are free to go on and continue seeing your partner or your boyfriend or whatever else. Now, what this means is that you've had a lot of cases over the years. Now, we are talking about since 2009, where a lot of women will have been identified as low risk or medium risk when in fact they were high risk. And how do we know that? We know that because study after study from reputable institutions, British and otherwise, have shown that DAS doesn't work the majority of times. 49% of the cases, they fail to identify them. It is even worse, it is over 80% wrong when it comes to high-risk cases. So that means that in the majority of cases where a woman is in high risk of being killed by her partner or by a family member or whoever else, DAS cannot identify them as high risk. And what this means is that then you will have frontline staff members who want to help these women, but they don't have a way of convincing whoever is in control of the resources to help them and to give them further help.
So, Stella, if you could just inform me a little bit. So the government's review, they're not reviewing DAS itself, they're reviewing risk assessment as a whole. So is the suggestion that the government should replace DAS, use a different system, use a different questionnaire?
The government knows DAS needs to be changed. Jess Phillips is on the record saying that it needs to be changed. I think what happened is that when I went to this story first to the BBC back in November, and over the next few months, the government will have received hundreds of FOI requests. And I think that what happened is they realized that, oh, they're actually seriously looking into DAS. We need to do something about this now. They knew that it doesn't work. They just weren't doing something about it. And there are other alternatives out there. This is what enrages me. And I think that the reason why this has not been changed is because in the charity sector, it's generally quite difficult for one charity to go against each other. It's quite difficult for the government to say anything, but especially when you're talking about domestic abuse charities, these are not charities which are used to being criticized. These are charities which are used to, pointing the finger at other forces, which for sure should be taking a lot of the blame. But there are other alternatives. Mm. So there is clearly something wrong with that organization itself, which is the one that's been promoting this tool as best practice. And basically they are saying, oh, other organizations are free to use something else. No, that's not how it works. Because your commissioners want the people who are paying these frontline services, which are so absolutely necessary, so needed. Nobody else is going to do their work if they don't do it. If you are not doing what is considered best practice, then how are you going to get your next contract? You won't get your next contract. So these women that you're helping right now will just get no help at all.
Yeah. Stella, can you tell us what specifically is wrong with the DASH questionnaire? What is it that is meaning that women who are low risk, medium risk, high risk are all being, you know, are being let down by the system?
It's not just one thing to begin with. It's not just one thing. It has never been validated as an actual risk assessment tool, which to begin with makes it a big problem. Because if it is not validated officially as a risk assessment tool, then why is it that it is being used as a risk assessment tool to decide whether somebody gets more help? And if you ask Save Lives, which a lot of journalists have put these questions to them by now, what they have said, and they have told that to the BBC as well, is that it is not meant to be a complete risk assessment tool, but this is how it is used. Mm-hmm. And the reason why all of these sort of risk assessment tools started is because we realized, like, much like a doctor will be biased if they have to when they do an examination, whereas if you use, for example, an AI, they would be able to tell you, to give you a better answer. Frontline staff should not just trust their instinct. Their expertise is very important, especially when it comes to cultural issues, and DASH does not cover. It hasn't been updated since it was created, basically, and Safe Lives has recognized that. So a lot of cultural issues, like, for example, it asks questions about pets or children, but it doesn't have any questions about religion, which is very important in a lot of domestic abuse cases. It hasn't been updated in all of these situations, and it depends a lot on the... It doesn't correct for the bias of the person asking the questions, and it doesn't correct for the fact that the victim will want to hide a lot of answers for the person they're talking to. But there are a lot of things. It's not just one thing. And every organization you ask, they will tell you something different. But what's important is that there is an alternative out there. There are many alternatives out there. And I just want an answer for why Safe Lives have not updated their tools. And I find the fact that they're abdicating their responsibility to be so pathetic when it is women's lives that are in danger. And we know that there are at least 50 women from the investigation that the Telegraph did, which they only asked about 10 police stations around the UK. There are probably hundreds more cases. They found at least 50 women who died because they were marked as low or medium risk by DASH, and then they were returned back to their abusers. Mm.
So, Stella, my question, it's very clear to me, the data is pretty clear that the system isn't working, that DASH isn't working. And some of the surveys I'm looking at and the studies go back to 2022. So we've known this for a while. So I'm trying to figure out who is benefiting here. Why have we not just replaced this system? Government, it can be everything from incompetence to malice. Is it Safe Lives that is benefiting from the continued use of DASH? I'm trying to get to the root of why this hasn't been changed already. I mean, the Safe Lives CEO has stated in Reuters that the problem is not DASH, the problem is police officers' values and behaviours. So clearly that CEO and Safe Lives is kind of sticking their fingers in their ear. Is it them that's benefiting? Is it government? Who is blocking this any change?
And it's shameless that she said that. It's such an abdication of responsibility. Mm. If that is the case, then why have they not tested their tool? Why would they not officially go and officially do some research on your own tool, publish the research? Because the research that's out there doesn't say what you need is more training, which again is very shameless of
them. Do they receive money?
They would be the ones getting paid for more training.
Okay, so that's what it is. Yeah.
Oh, the problem is give us more money to do more training, but they don't have the capacity, they don't have the institutional know-how to do the validation necessary and to update it. And there are alternatives out there. And this is what is I find so frustrating. If I had to guess, and again, this is my opinion, I'm just guessing, I've never met the victims commissioner in person. And I do feel, I'm from the charity sector, I really despise the fact that I'm speaking against the domestic violence charity sector right now, because it is true that, you know, they need more money. I don't want to see any of these charities not being supported. But the victims commissioner, she used to work at Safe Lives at an earlier stage in her career. Jess Phillips had built her career out on the domestic violence sector. She could not be coming out after one of the biggest players, which is so entrenched in the domestic violence space. And this is why it is so problematic. There is such a conflict of interest that they keep on giving Safe Lives so much power and so much influence, and they're handing them these massive contracts. This year, they handed Safe Lives a £53 million contract, not for dust, by the way, for something different, and without it going into tender. Mm-hmm. And I'm all for civil servants not being bogged down by bureaucracy and trusting charities who have been proven to do good work, who have performed at a high standard. But why Safe Lives being given this when they have failed to change their own tool? Clearly, they do not have it in them institutionally or otherwise, or they don't have the self-awareness at least.
Yes. And it's, sorry, can I just, sorry. And this review is Labour appointed Safe Lives to do the review. So they're checking their own homework here, no?
Yes, and now they're arguing with me, and they're saying it wasn't a review, it was never meant a review, it wasn't about the risk assessment tool specifically, blah, blah, blah. And I have asked them, and other journalists have asked them, can you confirm that risk assessment tools were never part of this conversation? And they haven't, they will not confirm that. And the reason they will not confirm that is because, of course, they were part of the conversation. And I have seen emails from other organizations where they are referencing risk assessment tools from one of the first meetings that they had for this project gathering insights and whatever else they want to call it. Which tells me that they were talking about risk assessment tools, because how could you not be talking about risk assessment tools when you have, I've seen a letter from the Home Office, which literally says, this is to look into how we identify, assess, and manage risks. How do frontline staff in the UK identify, assess, and manage risk? Well, the majority of them use DAS.
There are a lot of issues here in this particular case. Obviously, procurement is one. Obviously, potential conflict of interest there. You speak about Jess Phillips having worked in the charity sector.
No, not Jess Phillips, the victim commissioner. And I think that for Jess Phillips, it's just more difficult because she's from the sector. So it's hard with when it's the people you've been campaigning with for a long time. It's very hard to just go and criticize them and...
Yeah, sorry. I mean, yeah, she's worked obviously for a long time with victims of domestic violence, you know, those kind of charities, etc. But there is a broader issue here as well, which is how seriously is this Labour government taking the issue of violence against women and girls? And obviously all this is occurring, this story is unfolding in a time where VOG, violence against women and girls, is being co-opted by the right, by the populist right, the far right, whatever you want to call it, as part of their anti-immigration rhetoric. How key is this? I mean, if Labour are, you know, Labour have pledged to half instance of violence against women and girls, it doesn't necessarily, you know, how do we track that? But more broadly, stuff like this obviously plays into the far right's hands, does it not? It shows that this is a government that isn't really taking the issue of VOG seriously.
And the reason why I'm very scared, actually, when it comes to Labour saying that this is a priority, and with the fact that we may have a reform government in 4 years' time, is that the risk assessment, the level of risk required for a victim to get more support is very important, because when you have a right-wing government coming in, they're immediately looking for places to cut services and to cut funding. And the easiest thing you can do to cut funding from the domestic violence sector is to say, I'm going to keep the risk level for when you need to escalate low, so that the police doesn't have to act further, we don't have to find a space for these women in the domestic abuse shelter, and all of this without looking like you are basically cutting money from domestic abuse services, without looking like you're harming your domestic abuse agenda. And this is why it is so important for the Labour Party to get this, to pin this down right now, because if they don't, we will be in a very dangerous situation 4 years down the line. I bet you a reform government will be very happy to see more money leaving the domestic abuse sector and going into wherever else they want to go. Mm.
Stella, I'm still a little bit stuck on, you said 50 women have died as a result of being sent back into with their partners as a result of failures in being able to identify the level of risk that they have back home. That's national. That's got to be a national scandal, surely.
It is. It is. It's going to be bigger than Horizon, and a lot more are coming at the moment. There are a lot of investigations going on at the moment. This is 50 women from the requests, the FOI requests that the Telegraph did in just 10 police stations in the UK. Just 10. There are going to be hundreds of victims, and their families are not only now realizing that the reason why the cases of their family members were not escalated, the reason why they were not being able to get help is because of this questionnaire, which is being used as a risk assessment.
But it's one thing if we don't know that the questionnaire doesn't work, but we do know that the questionnaire doesn't work. So every woman that's failed, it's not just a systematic failure. It's, I don't know what to call it.
Willful ignorance.
A national scandal, essentially throwing women into areas where they are going to be killed by their partners because there is a refusal to act on a questionnaire that we know doesn't work.
Exactly. And I'll tell you why I realize that this is a massive scandal and that this is an actual story. This is not just a dysfunction in one industry. I was working for a criminal justice society when I found out about JAS. And I invited someone else who had created another risk assessment tool. There was this German startup called Frontline. Who were doing a new risk assessment tool, and they came to present it to us. And that's how I realized how bad DAS is, because that's when they told us DAS is correct just 51% of the time. Their tool was 80 to 98% of the time correct. Mm. And it's super easy to use, and they were willing to give it to us for free because they wanted to trial it. They were going to give it to us for free. And I asked around in my organization, can we just use it then? Shouldn't we just use this one? This is so much better. And they said, no, that's not how it works. We have to get permission from the commissioner, and we would have to trial it alongside us. And it was a whole host of problems. And then the BBC did hundreds of FOI requests to see whether DAS is actually required in the contracts of these services when they're being commissioned. And it is written in the contracts that they use DAS.
Stella, final question before we go, if you could be quick, please. Where are we at now? What is coming from the government on this? I mean, if you say journalists are increasingly sniffing around, is this something that they're going to sort out quickly, do you hope? Or is it going to go on
they
and on?
They can. If they want to, they can. That's what Germany did. That's what Malta had to do. But Malta couldn't do that because they had to be sued to do that first. So maybe our government can just do the mature thing. It's very easy. Just go out there, get another risk assessment tool, pick whichever one you want that's better. The police is using data. It's not amazing. But use another one. Just do it.
Okay. Thank you so much, Stella, for joining us. That was Stella Tenikidu. She was writing in the New Statesman this week about whether Labour have let down abused women.
FUBAR Radio. Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Are you aware of the tea alarm?
Tell me more.
Yeah, so it's this cultural phenomenon that we have in Britain. It's an alarm at 3 p.m. Where everybody in the UK has to have a cup of tea, and if you miss it by a certain number of minutes, you get fined, basically.
This ain't real. This is not real. I'm not playing into this. Yeah. You think me watching Keeping Up Appearances, you think Mrs. Bouquet was missing a 3 o'clock tea alarm? Y'all won't get me.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When I've met people in the past, I'm like, oh yeah, I really love him, he's the one. But I just knew they weren't. I'd say it, but I knew I didn't mean it. But when I met you, there was a different feeling. Like, it's like your gut just tells you. When people used to say, when you know, I was like, I'll piss off. But when you know.
When I met you and times got hard, I would come up with a strategy to make it better.
Death, a funny business on Foo Bar Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
So we've got Dr. Matt Morgan. Someone's heart stopped beating for 8 hours.
So he was stuck on a ledge in a freezing snowstorm. And his heart stopped for an amazing 9 hours. He's still the world's longest surviving cardiac arrest patient. And he lived because he was cold. You know, there's a saying, you're not dead until you're warm and dead.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Right, we're rounding out the show today with The Week Unwrapped.
Yes, with recess nearly over, Nigel Farage and the Reform Party have been dominating the news over summer. Now, the question is, while they've been dominating the news, what on earth have the government been up to? Are the other parties simply dancing to Nigel Farage's tune and giving him space on the airwaves? According to analysis in Playbook PM, which is, if you don't know, is Westminster's insidery newsletter that every journo, hack, policy, wonk MP receives at about 5 p.m. every day during the week, Farage answered 45 questions from journos in 24 hours. That's more than Starmer has all recess. Farage has also been on Question Time 36 times, which is outrageous, whilst Corbyn, in 42 years as an MP and party leader for 5 years, has only been on, reportedly, 3 times. I mean, part of this is media bias, right?
Yeah.
But I often have this argument with people, because they say, just ignore Farage. If you ignore Farage, he'll go away. And the media is complicit because they're always giving airtime to Farage. And it is true. You know, I've worked in a news organisation, an online news organisation, where they constantly want copy about Farage reform. But the reason is because people read it. People love reading and learning about Nigel Farage. And when people refuse to pay for journalism, and the way journalism makes money is by clicks, because through advertisers, whatever, they have to produce stories on things people want to read. So it's a vicious circle. The more we report, the only way these media organisations can survive is by reporting on Farage and getting clicks. And that feeds people's interest in Farage. And it's just this vicious, vicious circle, which is obviously going to, it also gave rise to Donald Trump.
Yeah, so I, ironically enough, I am critical of the amount that the media is Trumpifying Farage. I do think that's a bit of a problem, because you create a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, an endless cycle of you give him more coverage and then you say people want to see more of him, but it's because you've given him more power coverage that people want to see more of him. But I don't actually think, I think a lot of the blame and the problem also lies with the other political leaders and the other political parties. Farage doesn't just get on the news and get on the media. He knows how to use it effectively. He knows how to feed new pieces of information in. He knows how to be disruptive in the media. And he definitely knows how to blend a level of entertainment and populism with his messaging. The problem is that other political parties, and certainly the Labour Party, have struggled completely and in some cases refused to provide an alternative story. I've said on the show previously, I'm a big believer, and have been for a long time, that the art of political communications is about competing stories. They tell one story, we tell one story. Whichever story is more enticing is the one that voters go for. It's how human beings literally, like,
understand the world around them. It's through stories. That's why from like the age of 3 to 4 years old, we're told parables about how to behave. Now, the only reason I say that is because this week, as Farage did his whole deportations and we need mass deportations, the Keir Starmer, as the Prime Minister, I don't know where he was, refused to condemn it, refused to resist that messaging.
Well, not only that, he also put out videos and things on his social media with, I would say, pretty racially loaded photos of men being bundled into police cells.
Yeah, he's put four photos of and called for the fact that he has removed more people in office than the Conservatives did in the final year or whatever. And all four photos are of black men.
Mm. And
The problem, how many times have I bashed my head against the wall and you have on this show? You're not going to out Farage. You're not going to out right-wing populist people like Lee Anderson, right? The more space you give them, the more they dominate you.
And all you do is, if you put a photo of a black man in handcuffs being led into a police cell while all this rhetoric is going on, is that you are basically saying, yeah, this is a problem.
Yeah.
You know, these people are, we need to look out for them. We need to bundle them into police cells.
And in what world, this is what I just can't understand, what's going on at number 10. In what world do they believe that ceding that ground, that yeah, there is a problem with these migrants and these people that like look different and sound different to us being in the country, in what world do they think that the end of that communication strategy will lead to reform voters going, yeah, Keir Starmer's the one that fixes that problem?
No, absolutely. Okay, look, we're going to move on.
Lunacy.
We've got two more stories we want to get to before the end of the programme. Next is on energy price cap increase. Ali, take us through this.
Yeah, gas and electricity prices will rise by 2% for millions of households under the latest cap announcements by energy regulator Ofgem. This doesn't bode very well for the government, who made key promises to keep the bills down. That 2% on average, I think, equates to £35 for millions of households. Zoe, how long can this go on for? How long can water prices, energy prices continue to go up while in essence, monopoly continues to exist in our country over these services?
It's outrageous. Do you want to know how much my Thames water bill is?
Yeah.
£75 a month.
That's insane. And by the way, it's the most incompetent company in the history of the world.
But do you know what else it's doing? It's making me absolutely paranoid that we've got a leak somewhere under the floorboards, because I can't believe it's that much. But like, it's outrageous. And, you know, all of this is in the context of potentially, you know, conversation about tax rises. We also know that food price inflation has gone up massively, and that is only going to get worse with climate change. Yeah. I mean, it's always a knock-on effect with food prices. I think we had one of the driest summers yet. Mm. So the prices of all these things are going up and up. What can the government do about it? I mean, part of this might be a job for the regulator, but ultimately,
Ofgem is a toothless, useless organisation.
It does nothing. It's just, you know, and meanwhile, all these companies are, you know, claiming massive profits for their shareholders. Yeah. It's just this disparity between the rich and the poor. And it's not even the rich and the poor. It's the rich and everyone else now.
Yeah. I do have a question, because we've previously spoken about the differences of wealth tax and other things on this show, and our comments are always filled with people who I assume aren't themselves billionaires and millionaires standing up for the billionaires and millionaires when we say that they have to give more. So I've got a question for those people who are constantly in our comments. Now that we have millions of people having their gas and electricity prices put up by this monopoly mafia of energy companies, who, by the way, that money goes towards tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds of bonuses to their bosses, who happen to be billionaires and millionaires. Where is your outrage then? It's remarkable to me that people who aren't in the very richest of our society will be outraged by the fact that we say that those with the broadest shoulders should carry more of a burden in times of crisis. But when those with the broadest shoulders, the very richest in our society, continue to punch us in the face and continue to raise energy prices, gas prices, water prices on ordinary people and millions of households, fucking silence.
Yeah. I would also add that for the anti-net zero brigade, who will come and say, oh, well, this is all because of renewables. Actually, we know that the gas prices are tethered to the global market. And while we're still reliant on Russian oil and gas, we are still going to be tethered to those higher prices. Mm. So even more of a reason for Ed Miliband to continue investing in renewables.
A different Ed did a thing, didn't he?
He did. Davey. Oh, he's always doing a thing. Ed Davey is going to boycott the banquet for Donald Trump's state visit next month to send a message to the US president over the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Look, it's a very noble thing to do, and we talk about the crisis in Gaza a lot, and we feel very, very strongly about it on this show. But do you really think that Trump cares what Ed Davey does, or do you think he actually even knows who he is?
No, probably not. But also, fair enough to Ed Davey. I mean, look, I'm not a huge fan of symbolic moves, but at least he's doing something. Like, at least, you know, he's it's an extra news cycle of the genocide going on in Gaza. I don't really understand people who are always super critical of like symbolic moves. Mm. He's a politician in opposition. He can't actually pass legislation. No. He's not in charge of foreign policy. And so in a world where politicians love this kind of shit of going to these state banquets and feeling important and wearing those tuxedos, he's doing something. Is it going to change anything? Probably not. But at least he's doing something.
I think that's true. And I think what we do need is a vocal opposition in Parliament that has a degree of influence, which the Lib Dems do. You know, they have a number of seats now, who can be vocal on Gaza, because we know that Labour has equivocated far too much. We know that Kemi Badenoch, we know where she sits. We know where Reform sits. So I feel like it is important that we have that voice in the Lib Dems. Unfortunately, do I think it's going to make any difference to Donald Trump's approach in Gaza? The only thing that's going to make a difference to Donald Trump's approach in anything is just the last person he happened to speak to that day might bend his ear. Yeah. But he doesn't, I don't think he has any moral backbone. Or intelligent calculation going on in that brain.
Also, there's lots of conspiracy theories about his health. Have you seen on socials?
No.
There's is bruising on his hand, swelling.
Are you about to spread some fake news?
Why not?
Yeah, go on.
So there was swelling. We don't have much time, but there was swelling on his feet, and there was all these questions about whether that's linked to a heart disease, because that's a symptom. Obviously, we don't know that. And the White House has quickly shut that down. But recently, he was pictured with quite a big bruise on his hand.
Like he's had a cannula.
Oh,
okay. Very interesting.
See. Although I will say, Davey, I wonder if it also, as well as Gaza, you know, there's a long list of things I would rather do than go to a state banquet with Donald Trump.
Don't you just want to try the food?
No.
Oh,
okay.
Never mind.
That's it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. when we unwrap the week's political talking quiz.
That was really rude.
I'm sorry. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani Live.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at foodbarradio.com or via the Foodbar Radio app.
Make sure you download it from your app store now.
Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
FUBAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Let's go back to the beginning. A mortgage advisor. What does a mortgage advisor do?
So, the main purpose of a mortgage advisor is to help you to achieve the best possible mortgage solution on time and first time.